Again, we want to welcome everybody to DWC's quarterly stakeholder meeting. These meetings are meant to be informal and to encourage open communication between DWC staff and our stakeholders. That's a slide here. Typical meeting reminders, please stay muted during the presentation. If you do have a question, you can post it in the chat and a staff member will work to get that answered for you. At the end of the presentation, we'll also open it up for Q&A. After our meeting today, or at any time, if you have feedback or questions, please feel free to reach out to the external relations team. You can shoot us a message to dwcexternalrelations@tdi.texas.gov, and I'll also post that email address in the chat here shortly. And then with that, I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Jeff Nelson to get us started.
Thanks, Dylan, and thank you everyone for being here this afternoon. We do appreciate your time. I'm going to keep most of my remarks toward for the end of the meeting today, but there are a few topics I just wanted to touch on to start. First, if you all remember, a few years back, we did a fee increase for the first time in quite a while for the designated doctors in our program. Part of the agreement and what we promised at the time is that we were going to take a closer look at our DD program, the performance of our DDs. And we have been working on that project. And I want to just kind of update you on where we are on that. First, we have been working on a research and evaluation group report. This was part of our study agenda last year. And this was a study to look at the overall performance of the DD programs and also with a focus on the rescheduled exams that are taking place in our program. We're getting ready to issue that report in the next few weeks. I think overall the numbers look pretty good for the performance of the DD program. There are some outlying issues that we want to take a closer look at, specifically the number of rescheduled exams and also the reason for those rescheduled exams. You guys will see these numbers come out. We're still working on finalizing some information, so it's not really ready to dig into the specifics of it today. But when that does come out, I urge you to take a look at it. And we are going to try to come up with some ways to address some of the issues that are identified in that report. So please be on the lookout for that. Also, we are in the process of a designated doctor plan-based audit from our Office of the Medical Advisor. This is an audit that is looking at additional testing and referrals that are going on in the DD program, really to see if those tests and referrals are medically necessary. That is coming along well. I think they're making some good progress on it. We don't really have any preliminary results yet, but those are the two real pillars of what we've done so far to look at our designated doctor program. Those are going to inform possible changes that we have to how that program is run. I don't know if we're going to make any changes at this point, but that's what those reports are for. It's also going to inform what we're going to do for our designated doctor performance review process. We have been doing designated doctor performance review for the past, I don't know, six or 7 years now. And this is looking at doctors on an individual level, looking at the reports they issue, making sure they're complying with all the rules, making sure they're filling out their reports completely, making sure those reports are useful through the dispute resolution process. And based on what we find in these two studies that we're doing, we may revamp that process as well. So more to come on that, but I did just want to let you know that's something that we did promise the system we were going to work on. It's still something we are doing, and it's something that's sort of coming not to a conclusion, but to have some useful information out there for the system to review. The other thing I did just want to touch on, and I know Mary Landrum is going to go over this a little bit, so I don't want to steal her thunder, but the research and evaluation group, along with our medical quality review panel, has just finished a study on the AMA guides to impairment, moving from the fourth to the sixth edition and looking at the impact of that. Mary's got some really useful information about that report. That report is going to be issued tomorrow, but I did just want to thank the MQRP, our research and evaluation group, Mary and Chris Vogley and her team, as well as Dr. David Bauer, who is one of the doctors who has had a lot of input in this project. And without that team, I don't think we would have such a useful report that we have. There's a lot of good information there. Again, I'll probably talk a little bit more about it after Mary discusses it, but I think you all are going to find it very valuable. The reason we are putting this report out now is that some system participants may want to pursue changes to benefit structures based on the outcome of that report. We're getting it out here in April. As a lot of you know, those benefit structures are primarily in statute, but we wanted to submit it for review to the system to get their feedback and see if they want to pursue any possible changes to that. So I'll wait to talk a little bit more on that to the end. And for now, I'll turn it over to Santiago.
Commissioner, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Santiago Calderon. I am your Director of Designated Doctor Operations, and I'm here to give you a couple of updates in the DDO world. Next slide, please. Okay, attention all doctors, designated doctors, and prospective designated doctors. Who can apply? We're looking for doctors of medicine, doctors of osteopathy, doctors of chiropractic, optometry, and podiatry. How to apply? What do you need to do? Well, to apply, you need to pass the test at least once since our rule change. Pass the test at least once since May 13 of 2013. Take the DD Cert course within a year of applying. And if you're a current designated doctor, apply no later than 45 days before your current certification ends. These are some good helpful tips here. And where do you send the application? You can fax the application. Good fax number is 512-804-4207, or mail it to us. Mail it to our PO box at 12050 OMA, Austin, Texas 78711. And all of that information is found on the application itself. As a friendly reminder, the application is DWC Form 67. Next slide, please. Wanted to share some DD training events. These are our training events for the rest of the fiscal year. We do have a big training coming up, and at the end of the month, that is our MSK. Unfortunately, the MSK is pretty popular and is sold out. So if you're interested in coming to that, we do hope to see you at the next MSK, which is in August. In May, we have our 101. That's for the doctors that are new. Or, looking into being a DD, or if you want to get a refresher. So keep that in mind. And then our next cert course for the fiscal year, actually the last one of the fiscal year, is the weekend of June 5th and June 6th. And we wrap up June with our DD Extent of Injury webinar on June 19th. July kicks off our case-based series. Module one begins on Monday, July 13th. And then we wrap that up on Wednesday, August 5th. That's module six. And we wrap up August again with the DD MSK in-person workshop. If you hadn't already signed up for these, go ahead and take a look at our calendar. You can scan the QR code. And if you hang tight, I will post some useful information in the chat. We'll give you the homepage, our training page, and I will post my contact information along with a good phone number if you have any questions and want to reach out and discuss something. If no questions, I will hand this over to Deputy Commissioner Mary Landrum, who has some updates for you.
Thank you, Santiago. Well, good afternoon, everyone. As Santiago mentioned, my name is Mary Landrum. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Operations. And the REG has completed the AMA guide study that we have been talking about for a bit. And that report will be released tomorrow. My presentation today covers only the key findings. But before I present the key findings, I also want to echo my thanks to the REG group for the work that was done on this project. But I also want to thank Dr. David Bauer, who is on the call today and available to answer any questions that may come up. He is a member of the Medical Quality Review Panel. He led this project, and quite frankly, we could not have completed this task without his guidance. And of course, that of Dr. Lori Wasserberger, who is our designated doctor education advisor, along with the other MQRP reviewers who spent many hours reviewing the cases. Next slide, please. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, we have been talking about the AMA guide study probably for over 2 years, if not longer. You may recall that the Office of the Medical Advisor, in its 2024 Medical Quality Review Audit Plan, announced a study directing coordination with the RIG. However, DWC did not begin the work on the study, waiting for the AMA to publish the 2024 version, which included significant changes to the musculoskeletal chapters of the sixth edition. Those changes were published by the AMA December of 2024. As you see, the purpose of the study was to compare impairment ratings assigned by doctors using AMA guides. The comparison was between the fourth edition, which is the edition used for certifying examinations in our system today, and the sixth edition 2024 version published December 2024. So, for ease of this presentation, I just want to mention that throughout this presentation, when I say the sixth edition, I really am talking about the version that was published in 2024, just so that you don't hear those same words over and over. Okay, next slide, please. So let me quickly go over the research design to give context to the key findings that will be coming up here in just a minute. So DWC identified 17,480 certifying exams that were conducted in 2022. The last certifying exam on a specific claim was used. The certifying doctor could have been a treating doctor, a referral doctor, designated doctor, or RME doctor. Out of this universe, 375 representative cases were randomly selected. These cases made up the review cohort rated under the sixth edition by five qualified doctors of the MQRP who also serve as designated doctor faculty members. As you can see, of the 375 cases, 351 cases were assigned an impairment rating of 1% or higher. The other 24 cases were spine injury cases with a 0% rating. So, to focus on understanding the difference of ratable impairment ratings, those with 0% under the fourth edition would not have been included in the analysis. However, the sixth edition made changes to the spine chapter, which could affect the impairment rating assigned to this injury type. Out of the 24 cases, only 12 had a change in impairment rating. The 12 cases that did not have a change in impairment rating and remained a 0% are excluded from the data analysis in the REG report. The REG report discusses 363 cases and compares the fourth edition impairment rating to the sixth edition. The cohort of 375 cases included some non-musculoskeletal cases, which not all five MQRP reviewers were qualified to assign impairment rating. So these cases represent a very small minority. A note before we go to the next slide. So the MQRP members' ratings from the sixth edition were based on narrative reports submitted by certifying doctors for exams that were conducted in 2022. These narrative reports were based on the fourth edition standards, which means the information did not always provide enough detail to fully support the sixth edition requirements, potentially resulting in conservative impairment rating estimates under the sixth edition. Next slide, please. So the REG report compared impairment ratings for five different body part groups, as you see here, and six impairment rating percentage groups. The other body parts category included several systems such as cardiovascular, digestive, endocrine, pulmonary, and visual systems, just to mention a few. Now, I know I'm mentioning a lot of information that you don't see on the slides, but I promise all this information in a lot more detail will be provided to you in the report. Next slide, please. Okay, so for the first finding. Just keep in mind the next three findings that I'm going to talk about, they are not being mentioned in any specific order. This one here, so there was a decrease in the average impairment rating percentage assigned. The overall decrease was 1.6%. This number is important because an overall decrease in average of impairment ratings will have implications for the amount and duration of income benefits that injured employees may receive. So I'd like to point out that those income benefits are set out by statute in Chapter 408 of the Labor Code. And this is to the point that the commissioner mentioned earlier that we're wanting to get these findings and information, the reg report, out to you. So because of the potential impact that this could have on the benefits, to give you a chance to review, ask questions, and make any decisions that may be needed. Of note, 94% of the claims in this study had ratings of less than 15%. Next slide, please. Okay, so this finding is about the average impairment rating for the 363 cases that were rated. And remember, this excludes the 12 spine cases I mentioned earlier. The average impairment rating for these 363 cases under the fourth edition was 5.4%, whereas the average impairment rating under the sixth edition was 3.8%. This is a difference of a 30% decrease in impairment ratings. So, some points to consider in digesting that 30% decrease. So, lower ratings were expected and consistent with other peer-reviewed studies released by the AMA. Lower ratings are also understood given advances in medicine. And again, the MQRP reviewers rated cases using narrative reports that were based on the fourth edition standards, and the reports were submitted by the certifying doctor for exams that were done in 2022. This information did not always provide enough detail to fully support the sixth edition requirements. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, and finally on this slide, as the 59% of the 363 cases reviewed were assigned a lower impairment rating. So really to break this down by numbers instead of percentages, so 214 cases were assigned a lower impairment rating. 41 cases were assigned the same impairment rating in both editions. And then 108 cases were assigned a higher impairment rating under the sixth. So as you ponder these numbers and read the reg report that comes out tomorrow, consider this. First, evidence-based medicine and the science of impairment evaluation have advanced significantly since 1993, when the fourth edition was published by the AMA with strong evidence-based approaches. Second, significant changes were made to the guides from the fourth to the sixth, changing methodology from predominantly range of motion to objective diagnostic factors. Next, the sixth edition, first published in 2008, represented a continued evolution and introduced a paradigm shift to the assessment of impairment, focusing on a diagnosis-based methodology and introducing functional-based outcome measures. Finally, I'd like for you to think about the peer-reviewed research that has been performed that demonstrates that the use of the sixth edition has provided improved ease of use for impairment evaluations, inter-rater and intra-rater reliability, and improved accuracy of impairment ratings by decreasing the complexity of the process. And some of these points that I made, some of this information you will find on the AMA digital website, but it's also notes that we heard from our MQRP member as they rated these cases. So this concludes my presentation. I know that there was a lot of information that was provided in such a short period of time, and also information provided without you having the detailed report in front of you. I'm sure you have questions, but just as a reminder, the detailed report put forth by the reg will more than likely answer a lot of the questions that you have. However, I am here to answer any questions you have. Dr. Bauer is also available to answer any questions. And with that, I will pause for a minute. And I'm looking into. And at this point, I do see a note. So this is the first that we have posted out as far, or that it's going to be coming out to system participants. We are going to wait for any questions that come up to answer those questions as we also continue drafting our plans on how to move forward to the sixth edition. Okay. If there are no questions, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Martha Llewellyn. Thank you.
That was great, Mary. Lots of good information. Again, my name is Martha Leveno. I'm the Director for Enterprise Automation Services. And today I'm going to actually speak to maybe a little bit of what the commissioner was talking about at the beginning on the DD reports and maybe a number of reschedules and all that stuff. I mean, there's some very, very simple things that stakeholders can do that will help us process things quickly and also will help reduce those reschedules. And I'm going to go over some of those suggestions here. Next slide. So, reminders for carriers and their agents. And all of this seems really simple, you know, what I'm going over right now, but if we don't get this part right, or if we don't have the right information when the 32 is filed, that really does cause a lot of delays and could potentially cause reschedules down the line. So one of the things that I encourage carriers and their agents to do is to check the injured employee's address before filing the 32. Obviously, the injured worker, if they don't get their notice, that's a prime sort of a situation where there could be a reschedule or some miscommunication at least. Another thing is that we have noticed that there's not always all the information that we need for the treating doctor on the 32, if there is one. So if any of you check the box, carriers check the box that the there is a treating doctor, we need you to fill out that part completely. And of course, we do have some understanding of phone numbers, fax numbers, practice addresses. That can be a little bit varied, but the name, the license number, and the type should be consistent. And so we need you all to give us that information, and we need you to give us accurate information in order to give the designated doctor the right contact to get documentation. And that sort of helps kind of the exam process go a little smoother. Now on the DD side, what you all can do to help is that you can use TEXCOM to request reschedules, change in exam locations, and additional time. So what we have noticed since we've been looking at these processes is that sometimes we were just getting faxes, sometimes in text comp, and sometimes both. And so over the last probably 4 to 6 weeks, we have been contacting scheduling companies and designated doctors to encourage them to go through text comp. And I'm very happy to report that if you do make your request through text comp, we generally approve or respond to those requests within 1 business day. So not only is it easier for you all, it's easier for us, you know, and everybody gets a response within 1 business day generally. Another thing that I want to remind designated doctors about is that please file your 69s on time. This is something that we're looking for now on a weekly basis. We have a report that is being run, and we are doing outreach to those that we find that are not timely. Next slide. Okay, shifting gears to EDI. So, again, more reminders just to kind of help everybody along with the process. When you get an email from EDI support, carriers, claim administrators, EDI vendors, you need to respond as soon as possible. If you're getting an email from us, there is a problem with the claim or the claim reporting. And so we really need you to respond. Even if you respond with a question or if you want to discuss what we're asking for, please just do so in a timely manner because these are urgent matters. And another reminder for carriers, we are in the data period for PBO. So from January 1st to January 30, all IPs for TIBS that are reported and accepted by DWC will be included in the assessment. And when that assessment period ends on June 30th, we're hoping that we'll get you your results in the first couple weeks of July. And we are continuing with our medical EDI reporting initiative. So we are continuing to call training partners that send us medical data to ask for the prior authorization number to be filed. Next slide. Okay, and I also wanted to remind everybody that Enterprise Automation Services is growing a little bit. So I wanted to make clear the different sections and how you can get a hold of us if you have questions or if you need something from one of these areas. Feel free to contact us and or reach out to me. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Martha. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kate Sidora, our Director of External Relations. We do have some recent activity from the Capitol to report today. So, next slide, please. We had some interim charges last month come out from the Lieutenant Governor's Speaker offices and for their respective chambers. The purpose of these charges is for our legislative committees to study specific policy issues, monitor the implementation of recently passed laws, and conduct oversight of state agencies. So the committees will hold public hearings and produce an interim report in the fall prior to session. So why does this matter? Well, these charges often signal the state leadership priorities that they have for committee, and the committees will then also report and include findings and recommendations that are used as the basis for bills filed in the upcoming session. So while there was nothing specifically mentioning workers' compensation released in the charges, many of these committees will be covering policy topics that may indirectly impact us in the workers' comp industry. So I was just going to give you all some high-level overview of some of the committees and those charges, starting with what we're eyeing in the House. So our Committee of Jurisdiction, the Trade, Workforce, and Economic Development Committee, will be studying state agency workforce and economic development programs and their ability to prevent, detect, and address fraud. They'll be looking at common risk areas, data sharing gaps, design weaknesses, and administrative challenges that lead to fraud, waste, and abuse. And then hoping to identify some best practices and to strengthen programs while we are preserving access to those services. We also have House Insurance that'll be looking at impacts of federal health policy on our state programs and consumers. Those topics will include health coverage, access and affordability, health insurance innovation, network adequacy, and administrative costs and compliance. They'll also be monitoring the implementation of House Bill 2067. So for our carrier attendees here, that's relating to the reporting of the declination, cancellation, and non-renewal of insurance policies. We also are going to be watching House Public Health. They're going to be talking about artificial intelligence use in healthcare, the Texas healthcare workforce, specifically the projected healthcare workforce shortage and ways to reduce the impact on access to care and service delivery, as well as looking at the use of telehealth and virtual care models, including the impact on access, cost, quality, patient outcomes, and then recommend opportunities to modernize healthcare technology. There are two House Select Committees, one on governmental oversight and the other is healthcare affordability. And both of those have a few topics that would likely overlap with workers' comp or DWC services. Over on the Senate side, we are going to look at Senate Business and Commerce, our committee of jurisdiction over there, and they're going to be evaluating the rising cost of insurance, the stability and competitiveness of the Texas insurance market, insurer participation, coverage availability, and they're looking for ways to recommend increasing affordability, improved reporting, strengthening consumer protections, and some regulatory and legislative responses. The implementation efforts that they're going to be looking at are for Senate Bill 815. And that, as y'all may remember, it had is related to restricting the utilization review agent's use of AI for determinations, as well as Senate Bill 1964 and House Bill 149. Those are, again, both AI-related bills about AI data management by governmental entities and regulation of AI use in the state. And last but not least, of course, we are also going to be watching Senate Finance. They're going to be reviewing state agency strategies to detect and mitigate fraud, waste, and abuse. And they're looking to calculate the fiscal impact on the state budget, identify those high-risk areas like entitlement programs, contracted services, and technology contracts, and then again, recommending how to best safeguard public funds. There are links to both of those chambers official charges. So if you haven't already, please check those out. And all of this Legislative committee and prep talk is also my not so subtle reminder that the 90th legislative session will be here before we know it, which leads me to my next slide. So, next slide, please. We do want to hear from you. Please give us your input for some potential legislative recommendations. The interim is also our window here at DWC. Getting those recommendations to us now hopefully will allow us time to collaborate on ideas, and that will help shape and improve our system before the legislature convenes in January. So, quick how this will work. We're hoping that you submit your ideas directly to us here at the External Relations team. You should be getting an email notice from us next week that'll include a website link to an online form with submission instructions and deadlines. We do want this to be convenient, so you can use that online input form on the website or send us an email. That webpage link will also have a Word template that you can fill out. If you aren't crazy about using online forms, you can do it that way, and you'll be sending those submissions to us at the DWC External Relations inbox listed there on the slide. We are hoping to get those submissions and close that out by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 14th. A few friendly tips about giving us those, getting the most out of your recommendations and submitting those to us. I really want to encourage y'all to be as specific as possible, provide some supporting data if it's available, give us any necessary background and context, historical background or context. Our goal with this is to collect and analyze and vet these ideas so we can provide the legislature with recommendations that are both practical and impactful. We are really looking forward to your suggestions and working together to make sure that we keep our Texas system as the gold standard over here for the country. So thanks so much, and we are looking forward to it. And I'm going to now hand it over to our General Counsel, Kara Mace.
Thanks, Kate. Hey, y'all. I'm Kara. I just have a couple short messages for you from communications today. So next slide, please. Back in February, we were super excited to introduce our Comp Courses on Demand, which is a new free way to earn continuing education credits. You can go to the Comp Courses webpage on our website and look through the course catalog. All you have to do is spend about an hour watching a webinar, then take and pass a quiz at the end of the webinar to get that continuing education credit. So we're still offering our live comp courses webinars throughout the year, so you have a chance to engage in real time with our subject matter experts and earn your continuing education credit there. So now you have two ways to get your credits, so take advantage of both of them. Next slide, please. Conference, mark your calendars. DWC is going back to San Marcos on September 1st and 2nd. For this year's Texas Workers' Compensation Conference. This year's theme is going to be navigating the path from basics to mastery. So we're going to run sort of a dual track kind of format design so that everybody can learn something new to help out the newbies who need some more of a Comp 101 kind of sessions, but then also you seasoned professionals can maybe expand your expertise in some other sessions. Registration's coming up soon, so be on the lookout for an email in the next week or so. You're going to want to register early and get that early bird discount. So that's all from me. Thanks, everybody. And I'll turn it over to our ever entertaining Deputy Commissioner Dan LeBrier for the latest from Compliance and Investigation. Oh,
Dan,
he's not back yet. He might not be back yet. He had another meeting prior to this, so I'm assuming we'll just skip to the next person.
Yeah, come on in.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Dan, it's about
yes.
time. Everybody's waiting with bated breath. We can hear you now.
Now we can.
Okay. All right. Well, the computer's old, and I'm sorry. It worked 20 minutes ago. So I'm Dan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner over Compliance and Investigations. We're about a little bit more now than halfway through our fiscal year. So I've got some data for y'all so y'all can start to get a pretty good idea of what things are going to look like moving forward throughout the rest of the year for us. Next slide, please. All right. If you haven't heard me say it before, one of the areas that I lead is Audits and Investigations. This is the team that's tasked with compiling and investigating complaints of administrative violations that occur in the system. We're going to take a look at some of their numbers here on the next slide. Okay, a couple big takeaways here. We've received about 1,100 complaints at the halfway point for the fiscal year, and we've closed 1,175. What's significant about that to me is a couple things. One, we're on track to very much mirror last year as far as complaints in the workers' compensation system. The second part of that to me says there are really no trends to worry about. There's nothing looming on the horizon, nothing developing to really be concerned about, which is always good news. It seems like it's very much going to be just another sort of business as usual year, at least for compliance and investigations. Next slide. Instead of reading all of this, there are six things that kind of stand out to me that I'd like to bring to y'all's attention. Mostly some, hey, keep an eye on these types of things, and then one celebration. And we'll start with the celebration. For carriers specifically, communications complaints are down by about 43, about 43 individual complaints, that is. That's a pretty big downward shift from where we were at this time last year. I know we talked about it a few times in prior quarterly meetings about these communications type of complaints being on the rise. So obviously the carriers, congratulations to y'all. Y'all are doing a fantastic job keeping those complaints a little bit lower. The other side of that coin, and not so great news, is indemnity benefit complaints are up by about 58 complaints. So not a wildly dramatic shift upwards, but is something that we're going to be keeping an eye on and monitoring over here for the rest of the fiscal year. And then medical benefit complaints against carriers are up by about 17 complaints. So nothing really to write home about there, nothing too big. For healthcare providers specifically, communications issues, the complaints on communications issues are up by about 57. These are your late reports. You heard Martha say it earlier. Really focus on getting those reports in. A lot of people are relying on those reports, especially the injured employees. A lot of their benefits are tied to those reports. And, the more timely we can get benefits, the better off the system is and the better off our outcomes are going to be for our injured employees. Keep an eye on that. That is a bit of an uptick. Medical benefit complaints are up by about 12 individual complaints. Not a huge deal there. And some, I guess, good news, maybe neutral news. Quality of care complaints are exactly the same at this point in the fiscal year as they were last year. So no upward trend there, and that's a good thing. So next slide. Okay, audits and investigations, one of the tasks that they perform throughout any fiscal year is they also complete the audits of the workers' compensation system. Right now, moving left to right across this slide, we're a little bit more than halfway through our death benefit and lifetime income benefit audits. The slide says 13 are completed. That information is a little bit old. We have to get these slides out pretty early. We've now completed about 15, and only 7 of those have revealed underpayments, and most of them are fairly minor, fairly small, which is really good news. Y'all probably gotten sick of me complaining about death benefits at this point and hearing everything I've been saying about it. Over the past quarterly meetings, but it looks like we are potentially moving in the right direction on that. So good stuff there. Those are priority violations for the division, and it's a big part of the system and the promises of this particular line of insurance. So thank you for that. Initial payment of TIBS. This is a major penalty driving factor for us over here at the division. Very common violation. It's a large volume that we're dealing with. We've just sort of started to scratch the surface of these audits, but we will be working on them for the remainder of the fiscal year. And then on the far right, medical bill processing, we're about 5 out of 12 audits in on that one. Nothing big to report. Again, sort of business as usual. Next slide. All right, so here's something that I'm particularly happy about. particularly proud of and particularly excited when it comes to the contributions that my audits and investigations team is making. We've returned about $900,000 back to system participants. That's going to be, injured employees. That's going to be the people that need this money in their pocket for one reason or another. So I'm super excited about that. Great work from my team on that. And through our audits process, we've returned about a little over $60,000 to beneficiaries, injured employees, or our subsequent injury fund. And that's from six of 13 of the audits that we've completed. So great work there. Money going back into the right hands. Fantastic work from ANI. Next slide. Okay, we will quickly move through my enforcement unit, and I want to give you a bit of a snapshot of what they did in quarter two. Next slide. Okay, so this is going to be just quarter two data. The last data set that y'all were looking at was cumulative. It was quarters one and two. This is just quarter two. We've closed 152 cases in this quarter, and at the time of the creation of these slides, we had about 170 pending. Next slide. This slide is showing cases closed by subject type. That's essentially the identity of the respondent. We closed 114 against insurance carriers, 31 against healthcare providers, and 7 against others. And other is literally anybody that doesn't fall into those two categories, all other system participants. Next slide. These are the cases that we currently have open. We have about 136 with insurance carriers and 33 with healthcare providers, and just one with those other system participants. No surprise here, this data is year by year. It's always mirroring the cases that we've been closing. Cases closed and cases pending are always very similar. Next slide. This is going to be our case closed by disposition type. So this is how we're resolving the case. In sort of gold or orange here, you're going to see 89, and that's going to be for insurance carriers. Those are our DWC orders. Those are our consent orders. Those are negotiated resolutions to these cases in which both parties are agreeing on the outcome, essentially, the penalty. So 89 is going to be orders are going to be by and large the most common way that we close these cases. Now, the second most common way that we close these cases is going to be a warning letter. And if you look at the data on the left at healthcare providers, you're going to see that the majority of those cases are being resolved via warning letter. Next slide. Okay, and we'll quickly go through some fraud and fraud prosecution team updates. Next slide. It's been a pretty big year for fraud. I dare say a banner year. I'm very excited about the results that we've been getting this year. We've opened 41 fraud cases, we've closed 45, and we've referred 5 cases over to the DA's office for prosecution. Those cases will go through the criminal justice system as any other case would. Most cases, if there's not an agreement beforehand, will be indicted, and then they'll proceed to court. So, going to be a busy rest of the year for the fraud prosecutor as well. Because our fraud prosecution or our fraud investigation team's been really putting the pedal to the metal here. Next slide. Okay, so this data on the left, this is specifically for quarter two, the second quarter of the year. We received about a $750,000 restitution payment from one of the targets of these prosecutions. It's a huge win, and that's all money that goes back into the hands of the victims of the criminal case. So, one of the single largest restitution projects, if not the largest, that the DA's office has had to undertake. They had to sort of revamp their systems, and I think we broke a printer because of just the amount of checks that we were cutting to various victims in the workers' compensation system. Very excited about that. Huge result there. And over here on the right, 1.6 million is how much restitution the fraud prosecution unit has gotten for system participants in just this year alone. So again, gigantic victory, really making some strides towards getting some deterrence out there for some of these fraudulent actors. So next slide. Okay, this will be the last topic that we touch on. I think maybe two or three quarterly meetings ago, we talked about the insurance carrier scorecards and the fact that we were going to be making some changes to them. And those changes have come to pass. If you weren't around for those quarterly meetings, essentially the insurance carrier scorecard, among other things, will display the number of complaints that an insurance carrier has received. In the past, the carrier scorecards displayed both the unconfirmed complaints that we've received as well as the confirmed. Now, the difference is when we confirm a complaint in audits and investigations, we have made a finding that there is some sort of basis to substantiate the allegation. It's gone through a review process, and somebody has actually put eyes on it, looked at the evidence, looked at the alleged violation, and made a determination that it should go forward in the process, that there's something there. Unconfirmed complaints are just that. It can be a complaint from anybody on any subject at any time. The difference is unconfirmed complaints, they don't result in anything. They don't go anywhere. There's nothing to be done with them. But in the past, some of those, if all of those unconfirmed complaints were making their way onto the insurance carrier scorecards. We fixed that, and going forward, the carrier scorecards are only going to reflect confirmed complaints. Next slide. If you haven't been to the TDI website, here's the QR code. You can also just go to tdi.texas.gov. Next slide. You're going to land on a page that looks a lot like this. There might be a different background or banner. But what you're going to need to do is click on the workers' compensation tab on the far right. You'll see it highlighted in gold there. And then click on the carriers tab. Next slide. That's going to take you to the insurance carrier resources page. There's a lot of stuff on this page that we think is beneficial for carriers. But if you scroll down to the bottom, next slide. At the bottom left, you're going to see the little tab in the middle of other resources for insurance carrier scorecard. If you click on that, you'll go to the next slide. And basically, you can run complaint data on a year-to-year basis for all of the carriers in Texas, all the compensation, workers' compensation carriers in Texas. Some pretty important data on this. Next slide. But at the very minimum, you can look at a glance and kind of see what's going on with either your company, your competitors' companies, or if you're a consumer, you can see what a particular carrier is doing on any given month or in any given year in terms of their compliance in the system. So big change there. I think this is much more fair to everybody. This keeps it a little bit more, there's a little more due process involved in what actually gets reported on the carrier scorecard. So here you're going to see complaints closed in calendar year. This is a carrier's scorecard, and I've blacked out in red the name of the carrier. But you can see by month the type of complaints that have been received against that carrier. Next slide. And then you can also see again data for the entire year. So it breaks it down month and year. Next slide. There's also going to be some like EDI information that appears on the carrier scorecard. And again, all that's just for your convenience and for you to have the ability to look at a glance what y'all are doing right and maybe where you might need to focus some more efforts. Next slide. And again, you're going to see more of the same. This is just timely reporting of initial TIBs. Next slide. All right, that's it for me. If y'all have any questions, feel free to reach out, feel free to email me. And I will turn it over to Blaise Gerstenlauer with the update from the SIF. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Dan. My name is Blaise Gerstenlauer, and I administer the Subsequent Injury Fund. I am not R. Gersten. For some reason, I failed to change my screen name from my user ID to my actual name. I don't know if y'all can see that. But anyway, it's great to be here with you guys. I'm not sure the SIF has ever presented here, so I'm excited about this. Commissioner Nelson, thank you for the opportunity to share some information about the SIF with system participants that may not normally interact with the SIF. You can you change the screen there, Dylan? So I this just quick touch on this picture. I did not select it, but it's a perfect illustration, really, of why the Subsequent Injury Fund was created. And I was born and raised in Oakland, California, and I've ironically enough been on this beach hundreds of times, and it's a lot prettier in color than in black and white. But the Subsequent Injury Fund was created after World War II to encourage employers to hire. The thought was to encourage employers to hire returning veterans coming back from World War II with sort of the statutory promise that if they sustained an on-the-job subsequent compensable injury and were found eligible to receive lifetime income benefits, the subsequent injury fund would pick up the tab for those benefits. Now, obviously, the pool of folks considered for eligibility for LIBS has gone beyond simply veterans returning from World War II. It includes anyone who has a pre-existing injury that sustains a subsequent compensable injury on the job and is found eligible to receive LIBS. The SIF will pay for those LIBS. And over time, probably in the last 25 years, the SIF has expanded pretty dramatically in an effort to encourage insurance carriers to timely pay indemnity benefits and for medical services when they're due by providing certain statutory circumstances where reimbursement can be secured. And I'll expand on those five different types of reimbursements we have in just a few minutes. Can you change to the slide, Dylan? Thanks. Excuse me. So the Subsequent Injury Fund is funded through the payment of death benefits to the Subsequent Injury Fund on compensable fatal claims where there are no eligible beneficiaries. Typically, what the Subsequent Injury Fund receives are 364 weeks of death benefits on claims where there are simply no eligible beneficiaries, but the claim is compensable. However, if there are beneficiaries that have been paid or are being paid, and 364 weeks of benefits have not been paid, and there's a difference left over when a beneficiary becomes ineligible, for example, a spouse passes away or remarries, or statutorily parents, non-dependent parents are entitled to 104 weeks of death benefits, the SIF would receive that difference. Whatever the difference is between 364 weeks of benefits and what have been paid, the SIF would be entitled to receive. In the case of a parent, they'd receive 260 weeks. The insurance carrier can pay these death benefits to the SIF at any time after the date of death, but must pay within 1 year and 7 days of the date of death. There's an incentive for insurance carriers to pay benefits earlier. They're entitled to a statutory lump sum discount. And so the sooner they pay the benefits, the larger the lump sum discount actually is. So it's to their benefit. There is some financial incentive, but they are not required. And the time that they issue payment, the insurance carrier issues payment to the Subsequent Injury Fund, can go beyond a year if there's active litigation or dispute regarding compensability or beneficiary eligibility. Just again, kind of going to the reimbursement process, insurance carriers that do pay earlier than the year elapse date and an eligible beneficiary does come along, the insurance carrier can always request a refund from the Subsequent Injury Fund for the death benefits that they've paid early and now believe are should be going to an eligible beneficiary. Over the last 6 or 7 years, there was a time where insurance carriers sort of just willy-nilly issued payment to the Subsequent Injury Fund. And we've really worked hard over the years to try to encourage insurance carriers to allow the Subsequent Injury Fund to draft an invoice packet for them that includes a worksheet that reflects a lump sum discount that they're entitled to by statute. And we feel like we've been very successful on that. We probably receive maybe one payment literally a year out of sometimes upwards of 150 payments where we haven't had the opportunity to draft an invoice. It makes good business sense, and administratively, it makes things a lot easier, not only for the division, but ultimately for the insurance carrier, we believe. Can you switch slides, Dylan? Thanks. Excuse me. Back to the lifetime income benefits. The way lifetime income benefits payments are initiated is either the insurance carrier or the injured employee or their representative submits a petition for payment of lifetime income benefits from the subsequent injury fund that includes a summary of the circumstances of the claim and any legal or medical documentation that supports their assertion that not only is the injured employee entitled to LIBS, but that those LIBS should be paid by the subsequent injury fund. The subsequent injury fund administrator reviews this information, makes a recommendation. This recommendation is channeled through legal services. Consensus is reached at some point, and then if the petition is approved, an order is drafted, signed, and the initiation of payment of benefits is started. If it's denied, a letter is issued containing information regarding why the petition has been denied, and that's submitted back to whoever submitted the petition, the insurance carrier, the injured employee, or their representative. We enacted a rule February 2025 that requires the subsequent injury fund to actively verify lifetime income benefit eligibility recipients and whether or not the eligible recipient is indeed the person receiving the benefit. There was a time where this was done annually through a signed letter. We've probably for the last 3, 4 years been making monthly calls that we've memorialized into a rule that was enacted in February 2025 that requires us to actually have monthly outreach where we make contact with the injured employee. And generally, we've had a really good response to it. It's worked out quite well. We have a really older population. We have 21 recipients. I think when I started with the SIF, it was upwards of 40 recipients. There's no real reason as to why the number has dropped. It's not something that we can really control, but we definitely have an aging population. And so it's very important that we're able to verify monthly that the person that's supposed to be receiving the benefit is indeed receiving the benefit. Next slide, Don. The way that the subsequent injury funds activities have expanded over time are through reimbursements to insurance carriers of indemnity benefits paid in certain statutory circumstances. Those include benefits that have been paid based on an administrative order later overturned by another administrative or court order, benefits that have been paid based on DD opinions. This is the lion's share of what we actually receive, and the DD opinion is then overturned through either administrative order or court order. And again, the purpose of these reimbursement statutes and rules are to encourage insurance carriers to pay the way the statute and rule requires they pay, based on an order, based on a DD opinion. If there are multiple employers, second, third, fourth employers that injured employees have and are not able to secure wages from due to their compensable injury, we will reimburse those benefits paid when the insurance carrier has paid them. And then we also reimburse for pharmaceutical services provided in the first 7 days of a denied claim where the claim has been denied and no dispute has taken place within a year. And then finally, we refund death benefits paid where the insurance carrier has issued payment of death benefits to the SIF and an eligible beneficiary has later come forward or it's been concluded is eligible. We will refund those death benefits that we have been paid by the insurance carrier. There's good information, I think, on our web page, although we're actually in the midst of doing some work on that. But each reimbursement request that we receive must come with a form that the insurance carrier is required to fill out. And the form also provides information that they're required to provide to us. That can be found at this link here on the screen. And then Dylan, if you could change to the next slide. The QRL here takes you to our webpage as well, I believe. And if you have any questions at all, I'm always available. I feel like I'm pretty prompt responder. So please feel free to reach out via email. Email is always the best way, honestly, for me. So I appreciate it again, having the opportunity to present this information, and thank you. That's it for me.
Thank you, Blaze. And thanks for all the questions in the comments. We've tried to respond to some of them. I think some of them are going to require some additional outreach. So please take a look at that if you put a question in there. About the question if we're going to review the 2009 sixth edition of the AMA guides, we are not. We're looking to use sort of the most modern, up-to-date version of that available for that study. And I did just want to touch on the AMA guides a little bit more. We put out this study for system participants to look at, also for us to look at to see if it makes sense to move from the fourth to the sixth edition. I think preliminarily, it probably does. You know, we're currently relying on guidelines issued in 1993. I think medicine has changed since then. I think it probably makes sense for us to update that. That's barring any feedback that we get from system participants on you know, things that we might not have caught. Other interpretations that we might have missed. I do just want to let you guys know sort of our next steps on that. There will be more information coming from us. There will be some opportunities for discussion with us on a potential move to the sixth edition, as well as potential timelines put out about what a change like that might mean. A change like that is not just simply updating a rule and moving from the fourth to the sixth. There's, I know, a lot of our system participants will need to make changes to their systems. We're going to need to train doctors on it. There's going to need to be, all, you know, all sorts of steps that take place before a change like this goes fully into effect. But that's all things we're considering right now. That's all information that'll be shared with you over the course of the next few months. A couple other things I want to talk about that's on the horizon. Kate Storr mentioned session is coming up. We do encourage you to get any suggestions in for possible legislative recommendations. You guys know we are required to provide some to the legislature by statute. We have a few in mind. I don't think anything too major, but we're definitely looking for input from y'all on that as well. Also, if, I forget, a month, 2 months ago, we put out a request for input on potential changes to our attorney fee rates. We got some good feedback from y'all. It's probably the most feedback we've gotten on a proposal or on a idea in a while. Next steps on that, we are looking at potentially doing an informal rule proposal for you all to take a look at sort of the nuts and bolts of that, get some input, and most likely there will be a stakeholder input session on that as well. So more to come with that project. It's not stalled. We're just reviewing where we're at, working on an informal, and we're going to get moving from there. A couple other things to touch on. We've become aware, and we put some information out about it, but I want to take this opportunity to share with you all a fraud scheme that has been going on in Texas and in other states. Across the country, I think we're aware of at least six other states this is going on, potentially more, where parties are pretending to be the state regulator or a federal regulator or some sort of public official requesting payment from injured employees in order to receive a larger income benefit that they're owed. They seem to be targeting Hispanic individuals. Some of these individuals have workers' compensation claims, some don't. We don't believe that there's been any breach of our information, any data. We think it's sort of some social engineering scheme that's going on out there. Right now, we're seeing that it's more focused in the San Antonio area, from what we can tell. That might just be because that's a large population center. We have been trying to get this information out there as much as we can to the system, especially to the Hispanic community, but just wanted to put it on your radar. If you hear of anything like that going on, please let us know. We're working with other states on this, so any information we can get would be helpful to our ongoing investigation and our ongoing outreach efforts to try to educate the community about this. Last thing I did want to mention is that our conference, again, as Kara mentioned, is on September 1st and 2nd. That is not Labor Day week. Labor Day is the next week. I'm sure some of you guys thought that. Also, along with that is the Kids Chance concert. That's going to be something that Kids Chance is going to be doing moving forward in conjunction with our conference. That's going to be the first night of the conference. It's going to be with a popular 80s band here in Austin called Suede. It should be a really good time. We're going to be opening up a registration for that pretty soon, along with our conference. So please be on the lookout for that. We encourage you to participate in both. We had great turnout at both events last year. It was a really good time. It was a good opportunity for networking. Learned a lot at our conference. We had some great speakers, but we encourage you to start registering as soon as that opens up, probably next week. And with that, I'll open it up to questions if anyone has anything. All right. Well, always feel free to reach out to us. We're available. You can always reach out to Kate and Dylan or anyone else here, and we'll get answers to any questions that you have. Thank you for being here today.